Okay, here's just a few questions. Father Mel, are there distinct characteristics of a person who, quote, truly speaks from the heart? And what would those characteristics be?
This is something of a trick question. Because it is the mind and not the heart that makes judgments. If you don't believe me, next time you're over at the airport waiting for someone, sit quietly in a corner. You can have a cup of coffee if you like. And watch people as they go by. You have to watch them. It's not a question. You can't ignore them. That's not the exercise. You have to watch them. But you have to watch them and make no judgment about them at all. On the whole, what we do is we sit there and we think, we don't say it out loud, but we say, fat, thin, ugly, rich,
beautiful,
whatever. If we're walking down a crowded street, we do the same thing. In fact, it's very difficult to switch this off. So really, you're asking, the question is, can you use your mind to make a judgment about the validity of someone who is in their heart? And I think the answer to that is no, not with the mind. The heart accepts every person equally. The heart doesn't reject those that it doesn't like or thinks are not up to par. The one group of people I would warn you against are the ones who say they're any good. I've often noticed when going to monasteries, and I've been doing that for a number of years, that the ones I really want to talk to and learn from are the quiet ones at the back, not the loud ones at the front. I think that's the answer to my question.
Can I add something to that?
Of course.
While you're here. I'm just reminded of a remarkable nun who told us about her spiritual practice. She was teaching at a university in Chicago. She had never gotten a driver's license. It was therefore necessary for getting from her convent, she was a Roman Catholic nun, getting from her convent to, I think it was Loyola University, to take the bus. And somehow along the way, she'd learned about the Jesus Prayer, and what she began to do on the bus was to try to take note without being intrusive of the faces of others and to use the Jesus Prayer on their behalf. And it's a different way of seeing. There is the way of seeing that Father Mel has described that we all are very familiar with, all too familiar with, you know. A little contest to see who wins the beauty prize in the next 5 minutes or doesn't. And it's quite a different business to try to notice the state that a person is in. And public transportation is an excellent environment to do it because for some reason people's faces are very undisguised very often in these environments. And you can see the anxiety or even the despair, the fear, the anger, et cetera, very quickly. And I think it can be very significant to take that person literally into the heart and pray for him or her.
Father Mel, you said that it is not necessary to count the number of times you say the Jesus Prayer. What then is the purpose of the prayer rope and how should it be used?
I believe that some people like to use the prayer rope and other people do not. There is a tradition of using other articles, for example, small stones and so on, which could be used instead. Some people get a great deal of comfort out of the feel of the knots, and if the knots are tied in the traditionally acceptable way, and they don't have to be, but if they are, then you're aware, like almost everything Orthodox that we touch, there's a great deal of symbolism in the knots themselves, and that's another sort of point of contact with the spiritual world. I've never tried to say the prayer thousands and thousands of times, so I really have no experience in that area at all. Sometimes, in parts of my life, I've used the prayer with a sort of 100 knots and gone through. The good thing about using the rote is the prayer then prays itself out until you come to the big knot at the end or whatever. You don't have to worry about how near you are to the end or how long you've taken, or it lifts you from time into eternity and lets the prayer pray, and you really don't have to worry anymore. I have to say, in my own practice, which is very poor, I now have a generally exchange one of those timers you can buy at the dime store, which stick on your fridge, sort of kitchen timer, and get it to beep after so many minutes. And for some reason, that's what I'm using at the moment. I'll use the prayer. The rope is. I think I don't generally carry icons with me, but I do carry the rope with me, and that's a sort of, it's a sort of touch of, I mean, it's just, as it were, a touch of heaven, and it's very good, but it's not essential, nor is it the only way of praying the Jesus Prayer. Jim, do you want to?
We were born with a prayer rope. You can use your fingers if you have nothing else handy.
Is it really necessary to keep track of how many you do?
I would say
a number?
Absolutely not.
No.
It depends how your day is worked out. Some people are very methodical and linear in the way they go about things. Other people are very laissez-faire and fit things in as and when. And your own personality will dictate that. And of course, there's a great difference between saying the prayer 3,000 times at breakneck speed and saying it twice very slowly indeed. It could take the same amount of time. So there are many factors there.
I remember once at confession saying that I was saying this to Father Alexis, who at the time, since died, was my spiritual father. I feel that my morning prayers and sometimes my evening prayers are becoming too automatic, and that it's not Jim Forrest but Jim Robot who's praying them. And his advice was to, assuming that there wasn't more time available, to say fewer prayers but to say them more slowly. And he also recommended more physical activity, for example, prostrations, and possibly shuffling the order of the prayers.
If you hadn't had a spiritual father that gives you 10 ropes or 3 ropes or whatever, I mean, that's between you and that person, spiritual mother. Some people think along those lines, but not everybody. And I would have thought that's probably not very common outside of monasteries. In monasteries, monks and nuns are sometimes given just a list of things they need to get done during the day. 100 prostrations, 5 prayer ropes, intercessions, and that's why they're there in the monastery. It's possible to do that in the monastery. It's not always possible to do it in the outside world, and nor is it always desirable to have that sort of agenda, because it makes prayer into a sort of a task, a duty, which is, of course, is not. Prayer is a conversation. Prayer is a relationship. Prayer is all sorts of things, but it's not a duty.
Here's a question addressed to Jim. What qualities should contemporary iconography have? What kinds of icons are Orthodox working on?
Say the second sentence again.
What kinds of icons are Orthodox working on? I think it must mean now. What qualities should contemporary iconography have?
Well, for me, it would be like asking what is the difference between theology in the 14th century and theology today, and I'd say none at all. So the contemporary part of the question isn't to me the issue. It's rather to what extent can the icon be as pure as possible a transmission of the teaching of the church, the faith of the church, the tradition of the church. I can't add any more to that.
Do you like Father Gregory Krug's?
Oh, I like Father. Do you know Father Gregory Krug's icon? Some of you, I believe that Robin has a book of his. And if you're interested, he's in my opinion, one of the great iconographers of the last century. I think he did a great deal to help renew the tradition of iconography that is flowering very rapidly in our time, but wasn't nearly as easy to come by 100 years ago. Each iconographer is unique. You could say each one is a translator. I'm married to a translator. No two translations are alike. It's very interesting when translators get together and work just as an exercise in the same text and compare their work. Well, maybe you could say something about that. You know, I know Nancy will come back from occasional seminars that she goes to, and it's very stimulating to see how different, iconographers, different translators work on the same text. I remember Nancy's godmother, who was also a translator, saying, just as a little project, let's the two of us work together on the prayer of St. Ephrem the Syrian. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of a catechetical project for Nancy when she was preparing for chrismation.
Yeah, we had it in Dutch, and we worked on it together. She's American, but she's living in Holland. And we worked on it together in English. And then we compared the two translations. It was very interesting.
And the long discussions. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, Father Mel wasn't there. He would have just said, "You're both completely wrong." Or maybe unfortunately. Yes, I mean, today Father Mel actually did tell us that the word that he would recommend using for one that's often, what is it? How does it begin?
It's usually either translated as charity or chastity.
O Lord and Master of my life, take from me the spirit of
sloth, faint heartedness,
lust for power, and idle talk. But give to me thy servant the spirit of... And instead of chastity, he recommended sobriety. Not because it has anything to do with drinking, but sobriety in a deeper sense.
It's a fuller word than chastity, which is a very...
sexually charged word, and this goes way beyond.
That's not what the Greek says. So.
Well, or even for that word.
I would need notice of that question. it's a word that implies a godly life, and really it is not nailed down to any particular area of virtue. And I think the choice of the word chastity says more about the person that chose that word than about the Greek text. We always tend to put sexual stuff at the top of our sin lists, and that's what happened there.
Father Mel, it has been my understanding that Jesus said that no one comes to the Father but by Him. During the course of your lectures, which, by the way, I found enjoyable and challenging, which included multiple references to Eastern religions, I got the impression that you equated prayer with meditation as practiced by non-Christian religions. This makes me uneasy. Is there a difference between prayer and meditation as practiced by Eastern religions or New Age religions? And are the results of prayer and meditation as practiced by Eastern religions different?
Suppose I could answer by saying that I do not believe the word meditation per se is a valuable way of describing prayer in the Orthodox Church. It has a specific meaning in, for example, Zen Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism. It also has a specific meaning as in the various methods of prayer in contemporary Roman Catholicism. But really, you can't point to anything that we do and call it meditation. The issue of exclusivity, which I think the question carries, albeit as in a whisper, is it only worthwhile listening to Orthodox and to none other in the whole world? I would have to say that it, in my experience, and remember my lineage, Metropolitan Anthony Bloom, Bishop Callistos Ware, Archimandrite Sophroni, and Lev Gier, all of whom were well acquainted with non-Orthodox, in some cases non-Christian, religious and spiritual traditions. And I think it's always good to go outside a tradition to explain a tradition. It's like, as I said the other day, learning another language. As to equating, I certainly have equating I haven't done. There's nothing to equate. You can't add, you know, apples and oranges. It doesn't make sense. And certainly any judgment as to which is better is plainly absent. I'm an Orthodox Christian, and that's who I am. I really like an oft-repeated quotation of Evagrius of Pontus, Evagrius Ponticus, as he's sometimes called, who didn't make it as a saint, but he said some very wise things, a bit like Origen, who said extraordinarily beautiful things on a great many subjects. Evagrius said this: the Holy Spirit blows where he will. We can say with certainty where he is, but we may never say with certainty where he is not. And my own spiritual father, Bishop Callistos, has often said that it's quite obvious to him that the Holy Spirit works in non-Christians as well as Christians. We fall into a lot of misunderstanding if we think only we have God or only we have God's ear. It's not for us to judge the rest of the world. God created everything, including the Muslims and the Buddhists and so on. So we've got to be very careful that we don't somehow abstract the God that we understand as the God of the Orthodox Church from contact with the rest of his creation. So I would say to this person, don't be afraid. The Spirit of God is plainly in the Orthodox Church, and we know that. What he chooses to do outside the Orthodox Church really isn't our concern. If we have things to learn, must it always come from the Orthodox Church? My answer to that would plainly have to be no. When I was struggling with alcohol, the Orthodox Church had nothing to offer me. I was given penances by various people. I was shouted at by a few, I don't think I was ever given much positive encouragement. But when I needed to get sober, and it was a question of life or death, I had to go to a group of people, most of whom had never heard of the Orthodox Church, and for whom I was no priest. And I had to learn from them the sort of spirituality that I needed in order to stop drinking. That will always be true for me. I can never be an exclusivist. It just can't work for me. Now, I've taken a particular path, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody else, but on the other hand, you know, everybody has their own path and everybody has to learn their own way. But there is nothing in the Orthodox Creed that says the Orthodox Church is the only source of wisdom or the only source of knowledge. Our ancestral religion, if you like, Judaism, has a huge amount of spiritual wisdom that was quite available to our Lord. So to make it completely unavailable to us makes no sense at all. He thought and spoke and understood and preached within that tradition. And I think we learn a great deal about him by learning a great deal about Judaism. And then there's one last point. How controversial is this?
We'll find out.
We'll find out. I think I could say, if you had to sort of summarize my approach, particularly to biblical studies, I am very, very interested in the religion of Jesus rather than the religion about Jesus. And the words of the gospel, the religion of Jesus, what he actually said, how he talks about things, how he describes things, how he balances things and makes things important or less important for his listeners. Ultimately, those words will always be, for me, at the very, very, very center of my religious experience. Councils and the writings of the fathers are wonderful and very educative, but they're circles around. At the very center are the words of Jesus himself. And I don't know that I will ever let go of that. I think that's the most precious thing I have.
I noticed one thing in Father Mel's response that... I find significant. It is when you speak about Jesus, it's in the present tense. And one of the striking characteristics of discussion about Jesus within various churches is you can really draw a line between those for whom Christ exists but only in the past tense and those who find him in the present tense.
I'd like to say something that's directed more to the actual words of the question, which was about New Age. Something about New Age. You know, this person was a little nervous about Eastern religions and sort of New Age religions. I get the feeling I've got a goddaughter who was in the church and very, very active for a while and has now left and become a sort of anthroposophic something, which is very popular in the Netherlands, and it's all very New Age what she's getting into. And I have a feeling that the difference, and tell me if I'm wrong, but the difference that I perceive between Orthodox prayer and what she and other people like her are interested in is they're trying to achieve something. When they pray, their main reason for praying is to achieve enlightenment or some kind of, you know, to get somewhere. And so they keep on working at it, and they use various methods. But the whole purpose of it is to achieve some kind of physical change or mental change, and. It doesn't have anything to do with relationship. It doesn't have anything to do with submitting yourself to the will of God. It's just work, you know? It's just practice.
And control.
Yeah, it's control.
you have the illusion you're in control of something.
Yeah, and you're working at it. And I think, I don't know, maybe I'm really overstepping things, but I have a feeling that there's also a danger in orthodoxy for people who, say, have been told that you can see, you know, if you pray hard enough and if you work at it hard enough, you can see the uncreated light. And so they do, you know, they really do. And that's worrisome.
I was just thinking how that type of prayer meditation seems to promote reliance on the self and elevating the self. It's a different focus.
I had a very good friend who is a well-known Buddhist monk and teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh. I must say he did help me to learn to pray, even though I'm not sure he did any prayer himself. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But I was living with him in Paris, and one of my favorite memories of him is being stuck in this little kitchen washing an enormous amount of dishes one evening after a big Vietnamese meal, and wishing desperately that I might be with Mary in the living room among, you know, with an interesting conversation going on, instead of being, you know, having been sent and by no means with enthusiasm to the kitchen to wash dishes. And at some point, this very gentle, quiet Vietnamese monk walked by the kitchen, which was an open space, and noticed me there, and I suppose didn't take a great deal of wisdom or a great deal of sensitivity to see that I wasn't altogether thrilled to be stuck in the kitchen with 10,000 dishes. And he said, "Why are you washing the dishes, Jim?" "Some kind of an idiot. You sent me here to wash the dishes." And I was, it's an obedience. And, but of course, I didn't say that. And I said, "Because I'm not sure what I said. I can't remember anymore. I might have just grunted, you know, the love of it, you know." And he said, "You should wash the dishes to wash the dishes," which is a terribly Zen thing to say. I'm not sure how helpful that was. But then the next thing he said was very helpful. He said, "You should wash each dish as if it were the baby Jesus." And that was helpful. And then I discovered that this kitchen sink could literally be a place of prayer. And that was very helpful, a big moment for me. And it came from a Vietnamese Buddhist monk.
I think I can understand the uneasiness in this person's question a little bit. So I would ask, I like and have very much benefited from the Orthodox appreciation and willingness to see truth wherever it exists and not to be afraid. That's been a very good and freeing thing from our background. And it's, of course, right. There's a lot of wisdom, a lot of places we can learn from. However, nothing, whatever we can learn from different religions and things like that, nothing replaces the unique person and the unique work of Jesus Christ. That, I think, is what this person's wanting to hear affirmed. He may work in ways that we don't know and beyond boundaries which we expect. Nevertheless, it's his work, right? And nothing in any other religion can take his place. Is that true?
Yeah. I think if you do, can I add something to that?
Yes.
To the extent that we do the supermarket religion bit, we really are walking right straight into the quicksand. That I have a little bit of this. The icons are nice, I'll take an icon. I like this book of Sufi wisdom, let's have some of that. And this Thich Nhat Hanh that Jim Forrest mentioned sounds good, I'll buy his book on the Buddha. And the rosary, this is a nice rosary here, very nicely made. I think I'd like to have one of those, and so forth. And we end up with, you know, a bushel basket full of miscellaneous religious things. And we actually have nothing. There has to be a deep core, a deep root, and it has to be an unambiguous root that takes us closer and closer to the heart of the gospel. And anything else that we can find in life that helps us to do that is wonderful.
I have the temptation to trump. I accuse poor Jim of trumping. and that is something I said earlier in the week. In fact, I said it on the first day. and you can search your Gospels diligently, but at no point in the Gospel does Jesus ask us to be right. He asks us to be righteous, or calls us to righteousness. And just as I can see the unease in this question, but the question sounds as if we've got to be right, and that's resonating badly with me. It doesn't matter if we're right or not. The church is right. Orthodoxy is right. I don't have to be right. In fact, I can be wrong most of the time. The church is right, and always has been right, and with God's grace, it always will be right. That's fine. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Now let's get on with the real business of being good.
Okay. Can you describe again the heart set of being?
Say it again.
Can you describe again the heart set of being, being in quotation marks, and how to begin to approach it? That says Father Mel at the top. I mean, it's for you.
Good. I'm glad it's for Father Mel.
Should have said, Nancy, can you describe it again? Dan's going to follow up because I think he must know.
I've taken 4 days to discuss. I think, really, I don't know where to begin. We ended yesterday in silence, and that was my last word. Because, first of all, I'm not very knowledgeable or experienced. I'm just showing you where other people have pointed me. And secondly, there is no answer, there is no logical way. You cannot be mindful about the heart. You cannot do it. You have to end in silence. And I think I have to do that again, just end in silence. Do we want the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed? I can talk about. You want to talk about
that? Read,
okay.
Read.
Why doesn't the Nicene Creed say that Jesus died like the Apostles' Creed? The Nicene Creed doesn't say quite a lot of things if you analyze it. And the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed, this is a rather specialized question, have no point of contact. They were written for entirely different reasons. The Apostles' Creed started in Rome, and there's nothing wrong with that, basically, remembering that the first Christians in Rome, at least for the first 300 years in Rome, they spoke Greek. And they started using Latin, actually, not in Rome at all, but in North Africa. It was the Hippo Lot, Carthage, a Christian community that was entirely wiped out by the Arab invasions, that first started using Latin. You can remind your Catholic friends of that from time to time. And the Apostles' Creed almost certainly started its life as a question and answer catechism at the point of baptism. Do you believe in one God, the Father Almighty? Yes. Do you believe in... and so on. The Eastern Church, including our own, has never actually used the so-called Apostles' Creed as a creedal statement. Any more than it uses the so-called creed about St. Athanasius, which unfortunately was certainly not written by St. Athanasius, which is found in the Book of Common Prayer, and is found in Slavonic in a number of the Russian service books, but is never read out loud in church. It's a very wonderful document about, well, it tries to explain the doctrine of the Trinity in words, and you can't. And it tends to divide the substance and confuse the issue, really. The Nicene Creed was a conciliar document, and like all conciliar documents, I don't think I'm being too disloyal to say that, you know, the definition of a camel is that it's a horse designed by committee. And the Nicene Creed was definitely a conciliar document. It wasn't written by one person and then worked on. It was a conciliar document, and the needs of the empire at the first and the second councils, because it took two councils to do it. It was started in Nicaea and completed in Constantinople in 381. The needs of the empire and the church within the empire were very definite, and the creed answered those needs. The creed does not, for example, list everything that we as Christians believe. It doesn't even list most of them. It doesn't mention, for example, the mysteries. It mentions baptism, but it mentions there's no mention of the Eucharist. The very life of the church is not mentioned at all. So, be aware that the creed is not a sort of a summary of our faith, although we sometimes use it as such, as a sort of shorthand. It was a specific document adopted by the church for a specific reason at a specific time that we now have as our heritage. It may be the starting point for all sorts of catechetical work, but it isn't the ending point of any of it.
Good. Thank you. This is for everyone up here. As we listen and learn about the lifelong path of becoming Orthodox Christians, there are references that keep popping up about how we are to treat all of creation around us with respect, good stewardship, as a loving response to God's love, that we should weep for the harm that we do to the environment and work to change our lives accordingly. Patriarch Ignatius has a whole lot to say about it. The patriarchs as a whole group have come out with some strong and extraordinary statements about our treatment of God's creation. Many of us have backgrounds that put us in a political camp that pits us against our environmental care efforts and lifestyles. Will we continue to hear more about our need to change this attitude in our hearts and minds and bodies?
Ta-dam.
Ta-dam. Well, it always amazes me that there you have one group of people who, for example, are against capital punishment but for abortion, or they are for saving seals but aren't very interested in the people who are starving to death in the world. There's just this dividing up of things. And oftentimes you find people who have the most strange array of hard-held convictions, that each one of which is interesting, but the combination makes a very strange mosaic. I more and more consider myself a kind of generic conservative. But by that I mean somebody who is consistently trying to conserve what God has given. Conserve the truth, conserve creation, conserve life. And not to do it in a shrill way, and not to glare at anybody who doesn't agree. Because I've been so wrong about so many things in my life, I've probably got plenty of things still to be wrong about. So I might as well keep that in the back of my mind. They're not even far back in my mind. But to try to conserve what God has given us, of the truth of himself, of people to care for, of the world we live in. And try not to be so... one of the things we're talking about today is that if you start looking at the word addiction and you start looking at our society, you find that there are many, many addictions in it. And our addictions are many times not even recognized as such. They're taken completely for granted. There's nothing remarkable about that. Eat more, buy more. Why not? And to the extent that we become addicted to things, we may become abusive of the world in order to obtain them, the same way as criminals are abusive of other people's property in order to maintain their drug habit, for example. We too may be, as we approach the confessional, as we approach the Eucharistic chalice, keep in mind that we may be more addicted to some things than we'd like to admit, and more destructive in our relationship with the world than we like to believe, because the only way we can obtain what we want, the addictions that we have, is to abuse the world and to abuse our neighbor. Anybody want to add to that?
I agree that... sometimes in America you have a checklist that goes with your political affiliation. And I agree with Jim that it sometimes makes no sense at all. For example, why can't you be a Republican and an environmentalist? Of course you can if you need to be. Of course you can.
And a Democrat and pro-life.
And a Democrat and a against the political support of abortion. And there are many Democrats who are against. I mean, who in the world is pro-abortion? It's a terrible thing. It's not be pro-abortion. That's not where the issue is. Nobody wants to kill babies. That's not the deal. And there is a reluctance in this country to look at issues one by one. It's sort of as if we take them all in the bucket. You pick up one bucket and you pick the other bucket. And I think as Orthodox Christians, we have to be prepared to examine the buckets and look very carefully at issues. The gospel will give us, if we read it with patience, will give us the answers we need to conduct our lives. And I think we need to start to learn how to vote along gospel lines and not along party lines.
I should tell you that Father Mel was one of the people who opened up a session of the Republican National Convention and was introduced to that convention by our current president, at that time the son of the president.
I also know that I have two names. One is Archimandrite and the other one is Meletios. And he got them both wrong. But I also have to say that they treated me with very great respect, and that part was wonderful. When I first came to this country, I had a lot to learn about how things happen here. And it was pretty much, at least it seemed, looking back, it's pretty much at the time when wearing animal fur was all of a sudden, it was the fashion not to wear animal fur. And people were turning up at Hollywood events and New York events and getting splashed with red paint and so on. Everybody was talking about wearing furs. And half the people that were throwing the paint were wearing leather shoes. And nobody talked about that. And I wondered, what is the difference? Why are you picking on farming particular animals for fur as opposed to farming particular animals for shoes? I don't see. But you see, what happens is there's sort of a political fashion takes over. And it becomes one of the things in the buckets. And whoever's holding the bucket at that time has to follow that cause. That struck me as odd then, and I have to say, with great humility, I don't have much, that it strikes me as odd now. I just don't understand things like that. For a country where we claim to be free, there's precious little free thinking. And when we hear Christians speak, it's not usually the voice of the gospel I hear, but the voice of prejudice. There's a daring statement. When I hear people speaking on behalf of all Christians, I generally hear not the voice of the gospel, but the voice of prejudice.
I'm reminded of a remarkable book by Tatyana Gorocheva, who was a Russian doctoral student in philosophy. I think she'd obtained her doctorate, and she was living in what was then called Leningrad. She published a magazine, I won't tell you the name of it yet, that was regarded as a feminist magazine. And during the Olympics, when they came to Russia, I forget which year, she was one of those Russians whom Brezhnev sent out of the country, put on an airplane, not personally, didn't take her to the airport in his own car, but it was arranged with the KGB that she should be put on a plane and flown to Germany, West Germany, where they had heard in the press quickly enough that this Russian feminist was on her way to Germany, and so there were some feminists to meet her at the airport when she arrived. They were startled, however, when they discovered that the feminist publication that she edited had the name Maria. She was a devout Orthodox Christian, and her ideal woman was, of course, the Theotokos. The relationship with the feminists in the West didn't last too long for her. hurried departure. They weren't interested in the Theotokos at that moment. And then she lived in exile for some time. She was finally able, after Gorbachev's era, to return to her homeland. But for some years, she had to live in the West. She wrote this book, Talking About God is Dangerous. Some of you may have read it. It was a very popular book at the time. And when I first heard about it, I assumed it had to do with the difficulty, obvious difficulty, of openly revealing in public life one's religious faith while being in the Soviet Union. And of course, she had suffered for her faith in the Soviet Union, so the title made sense. But in fact, what she was referring to was her experience of Christianity in the West. She'd turn on the radio, turn on the television, and hear people speaking, as I wish I could quote the words that she uses in this little book, but talking glibly about God. Talking about God as if, you know, they were sitting across the breakfast table from God and exchanging notes or something. And this is where this title of the book comes from. It's very dangerous to speak glibly about God. And I think that's one of the problems we have in the West. We are free to speak about God. We've never suffered what the Soviet people suffered under the Soviet Union or similar countries, and there are many. We can say what we want religiously. We can form a church if we want to. We can form a sub church if we want to. We can do whatever we want religiously. And there is this tendency to speak glibly about God and to politicize God, which I personally think is extremely dangerous. Even when I more or less agree with the particular point of view being taken by this or that little fragment of things, you know, ecological or peace or whatever. Sometimes I think, well, I sympathize. But God is not a politician, and he is not the sponsor of our political parties. None of them.
We've got just a couple more questions here. How would a person know if they were powerless over something like food, compulsion to work, etc.?
I guess that's mine. Powerlessness, oddly, and for this you need to read the book 1495 at Amazon.com, Steps of Transformation, Meletius, Father Weber. I think they got my name the wrong way around. I don't understand it. Powerlessness is not a bad thing. Powerlessness is a good thing. Powerlessness is the step that you take, the first step you take towards recovery. And for those of you who are not addicts, that will never make any sense, so don't bother worrying about it. I think what the questioner really means is, how do you know when you're an addict? I once did a phone-in program on alcoholism, and it was, as far as I remember, a national program, but I know it was. And there was happened to be a caller from Alaska. Why I remember it's Alaska, I don't know. I don't know where in Alaska, but it was from Alaska. And this young chap asked me whether or not it was okay to drink a 6-pack of beer per day. I could have told him that I regarded a 6-pack of beer as more or less sneezing material when I was still a member of the Brotherhood, but I didn't. I mean, so insignificant as to be off the map. A 6-pack of beer? I always knew I was in trouble when I started my second liter of sherry. Anyway, my reply to him was, would you be calling a helpline to ask about
eating 6 cans of string beans a day. And he said, well, no, I mean, you just don't drink 6 cans. You don't eat 6 cans. Well, I said, there you are then. There's something in you that's saying there's a problem here. There's something that prompted you to pick up the phone. God bless you, but you are the one who thinks you've got a problem. I'll tell you something else. You are the best judge of whether or not you have a problem in the first place. In AA, we have a tradition that we never actually say to someone, you are an alcoholic. Sometimes it's very, very obvious that they are. Sometimes people come to meetings drunk. It's not that uncommon. And they might do so for a long period of time. And then eventually the day comes, and they may still be drunk, but they say, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And the room goes berserk. I mean, everybody starts applauding. At last! It is not a matter for somebody else's diagnosis, apart from health insurance and other issues of that nature, where you have to assign a number to a diagnosis in order to put it into the machine in order to get the money out. And I've done lots of that too as a mental health practitioner, but that's completely separate. If you are aware that you have a problem with alcohol, then seek help. If you are aware that you have a problem with food, then seek help. If you seek help, and seek it from the people that know, if you think it's food, go to OA. If it's alcohol, go to AA. If it's narcotics of any sort, the crack, heroin, cocaine, anything down that road, go to NA. If it's gambling, go to GA. If it's sexual matters, you've got a choice of 4. As far as I remember, it's SA, SLAA, the Augustine Fellowship, and another one. They'll be in the phone book. Go to those places. Sit around. Listen to other people talking. If you choose to talk, talk. It's all deadly confidential. There's no, you know, you're not going to get kicked out for not having something or put in jail for having something. I mean, there's none of that. And you will come to a conclusion at the end whether you actually need help or not. Most people go into AA because they are in huge amounts of physical and spiritual and mental pain. And as a therapist, I have to say, nobody comes through the door of a therapist's office for kicks. It's almost always pain that motivates. So as such, there's nothing wrong with pain. Pain is okay, as long as it motivates you to do something. Check out. If you got a suspicion, check it out. Check it out with the people that know. You'll get help. Of course, on a parallel, you also have your priests to consider and to go to. They know you very well, in most cases, and will have a lot of insight into who you really are and may well be able to steer you in the right direction. You may have other people, spiritually experienced people around, sometimes lay people, sometimes monastics, and so on, that you might want to consult. But I would say, on the whole, if you're really worried about an addiction, go to the people that actually know about the addiction. The person not to approach, and I'm not sure who's here, I have to say, on the whole, I'm going to make a judgment now, and so this is like, I shouldn't be doing this, but doctors are hopeless. They're hopeless. I went to a doctor and told him I had a drinking problem, and he looked at me and said, no, I didn't. And I mean, he knew nothing about, I mean, just, no, I didn't. I couldn't believe it. And doctors, on the whole, unless they're actually have been through the program themselves, and there are a lot of alcoholic doctors, don't go to doctors. They're not trained in this area at all. In fact, what they are trained in actually fights against this particular group of maladies. So that would be as a little sort of sideline. I would say, you know, yes, don't bother.
Have you found interventions to be helpful when people aren't aware or won't admit and they're hurting people around them?
You want to take this one?
No.
Okay. let me just explain what an intervention is. Sometimes, say there's a drinking alcoholic in a community, and the wife is at her wit's end, the children have left home, the dog spends most of his nights out, and so on. and the person concerned, let's say it's a man, because let's just pick on men. I'm picking on a man. Where are you? Yeah, there you are. I'm picking on a man. Okay, let's make the man the alcoholic. I was accused at lunchtime of picking on ladies all the time.
I don't have the microphone.
So you can't get him into treatment. He's not interested in. He doesn't think he swears up and down he hasn't got a problem, which incidentally is what addicts say when you say you've got a problem. Unfortunately, it's also what non-addicts say when people say you've got a problem. So if they say, I haven't got a problem, it's either an addict deep in denial or it's a non-addict telling the truth. But you can't. You have no way of telling the difference. They sound the same. Unless he's actually got a bottle in his hand, you won't know. So one of the things you can do is run an intervention. And it's a fairly modern invention. AA has been around since the mid-30s, and the treatment centers have been around, say, since the mid-50s, and most of them use an AA model. They used to use another model which made alcoholics sick, or when they gave them a tablet which would actually make them physically sick. Then you say, here's a drinks card, drink whatever you like, and then they do, and then they're violently ill. What this method doesn't take into account is that this is what alcoholics have been doing every night for years and years and years. Yeah. They drink until they make themselves very, very ill. So what's the difference? It doesn't work very well. And those centers tend to have closed down. Unfortunately, they were taken into the medical model. A lot of money is involved, and doctors are involved because they can administer the drug. I haven't got a down on doctors, except in this area. In this area, they're really not very good. So now lots of treatment centers are using the AA model. They're not in AA themselves, they've got the books. And I'm always I'm a little bit worried about that. Sometimes AA people go into treatment centers to have meetings and so on, but it's still under the auspices of these people who are actually making money out of it. AAs don't make money out of other alcoholics, not a sou, not a penny. What was the question?
Intervention. Successful or
useful? So over the years, this thing about intervention was, so treatment centers then started providing this service. That's where I was going. I knew that I was actually on a track. And for a fee, you can get someone to train the family concerned, and then you bring in families and friends and clergy and neighbors and bosses and bank managers and anybody else that you can possibly bring in to help in the intervention. You trick the alcoholic into turning up to something. You tell him he's going, you know, to the zoo or whatever, and then you take him and you plunk him in a chair in the middle of the room, and you put a whole bunch of chairs around, all of which are occupied by very highly trained family members. And you do what's called a hard confrontation. You point at and you say, you did this. And he'll say, yes, but, and you don't bat an eyelid, and the next person says, yes, you did this, and you don't let go until he somehow breaks down. As you can imagine, this is a very, very unpleasant form of entertainment. At best, it's very painful. What generally happens is that the alcoholic will pick the weakest link in the chain. I remember one family in particular, a very wealthy family in Missoula, Montana, they owned half the city, had an alcoholic boy. He was 24, 25, his name is Rich. He's now sober. I did an intervention. I trained the family. They flew in from all over the country. We sat in a room and put him in the middle, and he picked on a sister who was very, very, very pregnant. And elicited some sort of response from her like, "Oh, poor Richard," or some semblance of sympathy. We don't do sympathy in AA, ever. It's a killer. That was it. That was the end of the intervention. We all packed up and went home. He carried on drinking for another 2 years. The idea is the person breaks down, you hand them their suitcase and you take them off to a treatment center. 30 days. What they can do in 30 days? Might as well be 30 years. I don't know. I didn't go to treatment center, so I can't say. So, how many interventions are successful? Well, depending on who's asking and who's answering the question, I would say you have a less than 1 in 3 chance of it being successful. The people that make a lot of money out of them, and because of all the training involved, they do make a lot of money out of them, will say that they're almost always successful. If you want to believe them, please do. So, what was the question?
That's it.
Usefulness of the
answer. Usefulness, not very. Not very. Sometimes it's not even the last resort. What? No. In the end, the person has to hit bottom. And you can never define what somebody else's bottom is going to be. It's just that you can't do that. How does a person know when they've suffered enough sort of thing? It's undefinable. And the idea of the intervention is to bring bottom up to hit the addict. Well, it does work sometimes, but not very often.
Okay. Thank you. Last question, Father Mel. You might want to read that. Uh-oh. It's just sort of complicated, but it's easy to read. It's typed.
Yeah. Okay. At the outset of your lectures, you stated that the Orthodox Church does not believe that souls are immortal. No, I didn't. No. The Orthodox Church does not preach the immortality of the soul. That's a very different statement. So, I don't know who wrote this, but it's not actually true. We believe in the resurrection of the body. We do not preach the immortality of the soul. That does not mean that we do not believe in the immortality of the soul. So that later you equate the soul with what you termed the heart, yes I did, an aspect of our humanity that seems to be central to your understanding of us as human beings. Yes. When asked for clarification after the second lecture, you explained that the Orthodox Church does not draw a clear line of separation between God and matter. Well, matter is not God. The thing about the Orthodox Church is there isn't it that matter can be God-bearing. That's quite a statement. I fail to follow how this position supports your thesis that souls are not immortal. Well, I don't have one. Please explain. In your explanation, please identify that exactly it is of ourselves that persists after death besides our bodies. You seem to make the heart central to our personhood and you equate the heart to our souls. Yeah. So by saying that souls are not immortal... See, it's based on a
misunderstanding.
We don't. The church does not speculate very much about what happens after death. We do prayers on the 3rd, the 9th, the 40th day. We do prayers on the 3-month, the 6-month, and the year. That is a good tradition, and it is part of our tradition, and we need to preserve that tradition. Not all churches do all of those. The most common one is the 40-day, shows also the transition from deep mourning into more regular life for those who are bereaved. Some saints have said exactly why we do it on those days, but it's not dogma. It's not something that we have to believe to the T. It's just a way of explaining why we do these prayers when we do these prayers. I know with a certainty that God's love is stronger than death, and that the death of the body is makes no
break in our relationship with God, and secondly, is not the end of our relationship with the body. With that particular body, yes, but there's something more complicated than this, and we see an image, one of these through the dark glass images, with Jesus himself, where we know that his resurrection body was a body. He invited people to touch him. He wasn't a ghost, but we also know that he wasn't recognized immediately. He was recognized rather by characteristics. That beautiful story about Emmaus, where he's known in the breaking of bread, just as he'll be known tomorrow night in the breaking of bread. I mean, that, a very, very powerful and beautiful image. So that's the path we're going to be taking. The details, I don't know. I have no idea. I know that when I bury a dead body, it stays buried. It doesn't. And I'm not particularly worried about limbs hacked off in surgery in one place, you know, and that sort of thing. But some people get very excited about, you know, no. God can work all that out. He's very good at sort of mathematical impossibilities. That's fine. Just relax, will you? You know, God's in charge. We don't have to know the details of this. All we know is the love of God will not stop because of death. Frankly, that's all we need to know. Everything else is a story we'll hear later on. Jim?
I'll just go back to the present tense. I always am glad when I hear people speaking about Jesus in the present tense. That is where we meet him. This is one of the main points that Father Mel made so powerfully and repeatedly in our days together. That means now. It doesn't mean we think about how we will prepare ourselves to meet Christ tomorrow, or the next day, or when we die, or after we die. We have much too much to do now. And I think it's enough to do that which is possible for us here and now. This is the day of judgment. Today is the day of judgment. Today, I mean, what are the wonderful words of Saint Herman of Alaska on this very day, on this hour, and this very minute?
Let us love God above all.
Let us love God above all. What else do we need than that?
All of our questions. Very good. Just want to say that tomorrow we have liturgy at 6:30 in the evening, followed by a dinner for all the church and all of our guests here. And it looks like the weather holds. We'll eat outside. And for those who are visiting from out of town, Casey Jones, one of the members of our church, is bringing up his gold panning materials.
Oh.
Yeah. He does this right out of the back of his truck.
Okay.
He's got a bunch of gold-bearing dirt that he gets, and so.
I forgot to say, if anybody is interested in joining the Orthodox Peace Fellowship, you can pan for gold here also. We'll give you a few more brochures.
Don says if you order tapes, they're ready to pick up at the back there tonight.
Okay.
Let's see what else. Those evaluation sheets put back there. But now, mostly, I want to thank our visitors who've traveled from out of state to be with us. It really makes our time together richer, and we're very glad you made the effort to come. It's really great. Thank you for coming. And also, thank you to Russell, who's back there at the back, and Tom Webster, who's here, for helping set up so much. They arranged pickup at the airport and made this room magically transform from one place to another, and really appreciate their help. Also, of course, I can't name them all, but all the ladies in our church that help with the meals and the snacks.
Yes. Some of you were kind enough to show us bits and pieces of Alaska, and we wouldn't have seen them had it not been for your initiative, your hospitality. I won't bother to name the ones that we can remember, because I might mess up, forget somebody. But thank you for opening the gates of Alaska so widely to us.
Everybody. Dan and Teresa, thanks for hosting so much in the St. James House. And finally, just thank you, Father Mel and Jim and Nancy, for traveling so far to be with us and your effort to teach us and all the good things that I'm sure we will gain from it over the months as we think about things. And invariably, I pull out my notes months later and I'm going back over them and find more good things. So really, thank you very much for all your work.